people talk a lot about spiritual succession, and I'm like, well, if it's anything like regular succession, I'll watch it every Sunday night. It'll make me feel like I'm having an entertaining panic attack. Welcome to Triple Click, where we bring the games to you. This week, we're talking about spiritual successors and what it means for one game to capture and recreate the spirit of another game. Also, what it's like to be followed by a Pope, but not the Pope. Let's get into it. I'm Kirk Hamilton.
I'm Maddie Myers.
And I'm Jason Schreier.
And hello.
Hello.
Hi.
It's us.
It sure is.
It's hello. Us.
Yet again.
Again.
One of the great constants in my life is seeing the two of you on Skype and talking into a microphone about video games each week.
Thank goodness.
Thank goodness.
It's us again.
Thank goodness we get to make this show. And thank goodness for all of the Maximum Fun members who make it possible for us to make this show. This is a totally listener-supported show. You probably know that if you listen, because we say it at the top of every episode, but that doesn't make it any less true. We are totally supported by you, Maximum Fun members out there. And if you would like to support us making this show that we want to make the way we want to make it, with no sponsors and no corporate influence, no bullshit, just three people and the truth about video games, if you want to support that...
Wow.
You know, it's
Kirk Greenwald
really,
over here.
Really bringing an energy.
You got to raise the stakes. You got to raise the stakes when you're giving people the sell. Anyways, if you'd like to support us, we would love that. You can go to MaximumFun.org/join. Thank you so much to everybody who's been a member however long you remember supporting us making this show. We really, really appreciate you. Again, that is MaximumFun.org/join.
And shout out to this week's bonus episode, which was on the Outer Wilds.
Oh, yeah. That's right.
Did you almost say Outer Worlds? Is that why you paused?
No,
it's not
I accidentally added a "the" to Outer Wilds.
I have words that I mix up all the time, but I don't think I've ever mixed up Outer Worlds and Outer Wilds, and I'm very proud of that. Yes, we did a bonus episode. That you get all of the bonus episodes we've ever done if you become a member. And
it's true, you do. Mm-hmm.
We did an episode on Outer Wilds, Echoes of the Eye that was a really, really
fun
one.
It was very fun. That's why I wanted to shout out.
Yes, it was very fun. Fun to just like totally...
Spoiler-tastic. A lot of beans spilled all over the desks of each of the three of us. Good stuff.
Yeah, good stuff. Still cleaning up, still finding beans. But...
And then you had to figure out how those beans were spilled by carefully recreating the scene and carrying an artifact to the beans.
It's true. It's true.
Yeah.
It's a complicated...
Yep. Put one of those gravity crystals like near the beans so that they all like actually land on the desk properly. Mm-hmm. It's supposed to just floating around your spaceship.
That's true.
That'd be a real mess.
That would be a mess. Anyway, people who haven't played Outer Wilds have no idea what we're talking about. Yes, let's talk about video games. Maddie, you're leading us on this what should be a very interesting conversation. What are we talking about this week?
We are doing a What's the Deal? Cue the bass riff. What's the deal?
What's the deal
with spiritual successors, which
spiritual successors
is a term that is used in video games so often that today I tried to Google spiritual successor films and TV shows and Google kept asking me if I meant video games. And I don't know if that's because Google knows me or because this is a term that gamers truly use a lot. I think because games really do lend themselves to this as an art form for a lot of industry-related reasons and also just practical and logistical reasons. Mm-hmm. It's easier to build a game on top of a previous game that somebody else already made or perhaps that you yourself made. So just from a mechanical standpoint, making a spiritual successor to a previous game, much easier. But also, in researching this episode, I found a lot of funny and tragic stories about sequels that should have been actual sequels but ended up having to be legally distinct sequels due to IP rights issues and any number of other related shenanigans.
Nice. So, Maddie, what's this rubric? I see you made a Kirk-style taxonomy for spiritual successors.
I made a Kirk-style taxonomy. Jason thought that Kirk made this taxonomy without reading it. If he'd read it, he would have known it was mine.
Yes, it's very clearly a Maddie taxonomy once you start reading
written
it.
Written in my voice, if you will. Mm-hmm. I don't know how to even describe what my voice would be. Kirk, you could write cutesy little names like this. You just choose not to.
Kirk would write, no. Well, so you wrote, one of these is called The Stapler, and in parentheses it says, this is an Office Space reference. See, Kirk would have just written The Stapler, but you would have explained, this is an Office Space reference in your wry tone. That's the Maddie voice.
Because, I cite my sources, and I just want to make sure that the reader or listener knows where something's coming from. Like, if this were an article, I would have linked to the Office Space.
Anyway, explain. I want to hear all four of them. What are the four? Give us the four.
What are the four types of spiritual successor?
Sure. These are the four, and I will say there's some overlap between these.
Of course.
These are not discrete.
It's always a gradient.
T- types. This is not so much a gradient as a complex Venn diagram.
Okay, a complex Venn diagram.
So the first one is what I call the legally distinct sequel, and I described it as the original studio or creators lose access to the IP, the rights, and they have to go their own way. So
Fleetwood Mac style.
Baldur's Gate and Dragon Age Origins is a good example here. The stapler, which is an Office Space reference.
Thanks for explaining that.
The character who takes the stapler with them, of course. Developers quit but form a new studio that makes a game very similar to the one they made at their prior studio, such as Blizzard veterans making Torchlight, which we talked about on our Diablo episode, if people want to go back and listen to that. And the third category, I would say this one has a lot of overlap with the stapler, but it's kind of its own version of the stapler that I call the solo comeback tour. And it is the original creator of a highly successful game that was canceled or underappreciated in its time returns, by which I mean the creator returns, often via crowdfund, to play the hits again. So this is like a Bloodstained Ritual of the Night is Castlevania, but it's not Castlevania. Mighty No. 9 is Mega Man, but it's not, etc. These are games that were funded on the spirit of the people at the helm of each of the games, like Igarashi and Inafune not being involved in those Kickstarters, probably wouldn't have allowed them to succeed as much as they did. And then the fourth category is what I call the fan letter, which is a fan of a popular game creates a tribute that may or may not fix the original game in some way. Probably the best example of this is Stardew Valley, which fixes Harvest Moon and is made by just one person. And my other examples are also made by just one person. I had Axiom Verge and then I had Undertale. Here. And I just thought it was interesting that those were all one person operations. I don't know what that says about like the amount of fanish fervor that you need to make a game that is a commentary on or like improvement to a specific other game. Or I don't know if that just lends itself well to the solo creator lifestyle. But the fact that there are three examples says something. So, Kirk, Jason, what do you think about my rubric? Are you ready to get into it? Are you ready to rank?
Yeah, I like it a lot too.
All of the crossovers I found.
I think that it's really interesting. I think what you said in the intro is also interesting about how video games lend themselves to the idea of a spiritual successor, because that's not really a term that I thought of that much before I kind of got back into video games. Back in the 2000s, like you could, like there's totally things like Stranger Things is a spiritual successor to the Goonies, right? Like there are totally
or E.T.
or yeah. Well, sure, like that to a lot of those kinds of things, but like to that,
but you call
to the
that
media.
Inspiration,
right? Yeah, and it's sort of a more nebulous
or
thing.
An homage,
right? In art, like is Vampire Weekend a spiritual successor to Paul Simon's Graceland, or is it just sort of an homage?
That would
right?
be so weird.
Like, yeah,
to
no
say.
One's gonna describe it that way. But in games, it's used all the time, and I think it's because it's not that different than just making art that's inspired by something. But because you can take actual game mechanics and use them freely, because they aren't patented, they aren't controlled in that way, you can really make a game like Dishonored, for example, which is the spiritual successor to Thief and is just plays like a Thief game and works like a Thief game. And when you play it, you get the same feeling as a Thief game, which just feels somehow distinct because you're actually doing it. And because the thing that you're doing is something that you can like recreate over and over again without worrying about, I guess, being sued for it.
Mm-hmm. And it's also completely socially acceptable to say, for the Dishonored devs to say, this is inspired by Thief, literally. Like we liked Thief, we liked the stealth mechanics in Thief. And here we go, here those are, which they've said in some interviews. And that's not weird. I mean, it is a legally distinct sequel, I guess, but it's just interesting that that's socially acceptable in games to just say, like, it's not just that it's inspired by, it's like, we really liked this and we took it.
Well, because games, unlike movies or books, the story isn't the only thing. In a movie, the story is the only thing. In a book, the story is the only thing. And they're all enhanced by all the things, all the other things. The book is enhanced, the story is enhanced in a book by the scenes and the characters, and the movie in a movie by the music and the art and stuff. But it's the story is the thing. Whereas in a game, it's kind of a lot of different things, but also the gameplay as a thing isn't like a story in that it can be copied in some way. It's more like I don't know, it's kind of like music in that it's iterated on constantly. And so like it's like it's you can't you're nobody's gonna be like, oh man, they ripped off my chord progression for this music song, because everybody knows that like
well you could sue.
Maybe that's a bad example, but
no,
like,
keep going, because like, I think this is interesting and have a thought on it.
The
but
point
keep
is
going.
That Well, so the point is that every single video game ever made is building on mechanics from previous games. Like, there's a certain verbiage to a game where, like, I mean, how many games have you picked up where the right stick controls the camera and the left stick controls right. walking, right? It's like there's a language that game designers have just developed collectively over time. And so it's less of like there isn't really any ownership over game mechanics in the way that there might be over art or story or music and other things, just because there is no way to claim ownership over like the way that gameplay works. It just doesn't work like that. And then once in a while you'll get a game clone, like 2048 cloning threes or something like that, which is a different conversation. But in terms of just like building on, like, I don't know, like Stardew Valley, I mean, Eric Barone, I wrote about this in my first book, he met with the creator of Harvest Moon, who was like, who loved the game and was like, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. So I think there's kind of a more of an appreciation and more of like people deliberately building on each other's work in gameplay than there might be in other forms of media that I think are easier to just like copy and rip off.
Yeah, there's sort of a different culture for each of these art forms. And actually, the more we talk about music, the more I'm thinking about how there are definitely copyright disputes, right? And a lot of them are kind of like, I'm not a huge fan in general of music copyright like disputes, like the ones, I don't know, the Katy Perry one recently, this guy like sued Katy Perry, it was sort of ridiculous.
Yeah, but that's a little bit more specific things that they're disputing
yes,
over.
Yes, no, like, I know, it's totally different. Yeah. But I think that there's this, in actual, like the actual honest conversation between musicians, there's a lot of talk of like, oh, I totally stole that from so-and-so. Oh, yeah, like that was such and such. Like I took this idea for this sort of groove from this and mixed it with that and like took this instrumentation.
Dave Grohl just said that in an interview. Dave Grohl just said like all of his Nirvana drumming was like stolen from
I listened to that interview. I actually thought it was funny that people were treating that like it was a big deal when musicians talk like that all the time. Like I steal everything. Like just like everyone does. Because that's sort of like you said, that's how any art form, there's this constant conversation going on. And especially with that's kind of the more mechanical part of music, right? It's like you're stealing, oh, well, it was just kind of this way that the guy was hitting the cymbal or the way they mic'd something or like a way that they, you know, amped the guitar. Mm-hmm.
Like production techniques.
Right.
Like even learning like, oh, drums, a snare sounds really interesting if you mix it backwards and then you just duplicate that a billion times. And then like that becomes really popular for a while. But like one person came up with it and you can't own something like that. Like that's sort of like the equivalent of like hit a button to hit cover in Gears of War, which I know Gears wasn't even the first game to do that, but it popularized it. It felt really good in that game. And then tons and tons of other games have done it since then. And it's not like anyone can really be mad about it. It's just like, oh yeah, that's a technique you can throw into a game and have it feel really good.
So I guess, or like sidechain compression is something where like someone did that for the first time and now there's like sidechain, for a while there was like sidechain compression on everything and it was just a sound, which is like, that's all more mechanical and actually more like games than some other things. It's sort of similar to like, you know, camera tricks that people will borrow from like Hong Kong action movies when they make movies.
Yes.
You know, the technical stuff does allow itself to be borrowed a little bit more explicitly. And video games are so technical and made up of so many pieces like that, that it's a lot easier to just grab things wholesale and use them again.
So the other thing about games, I think, that really makes them ripe for this, for spiritual successors and us all being thrilled about spiritual successors instead of being like, hey, you copied that thing, is that games, unlike movies and music, go obsolete really quickly. And so like, if I want to recreate the feelings that I had when I played Mega Man back in the day, playing the old one might enjoy it, but like I not that much because it feels kind of
okay
clunky
to say
today,
that it's
right?
a rough hang. It's okay.
Yeah, so I might enjoy it for nostalgic reasons, but like I kind of want a new thing. And so seeing when and combine that with the fact that a lot of these big video game companies have just totally abandoned some of these old franchises, and you get this ravenous hunger for these spiritual successors because it's like, A, we want something that feels modern, that like that feels like it fits in by today's standards, and B, the company's not doing anything with this IP anyway, so like you're harming nobody by going out and being like, I'm gonna make a spiritual successor to Mega Man. Although I guess in Mighty Number 9's case, you might be harming some people when they actually play the game and they're like, man, this sucks. But
just had to get that in there.
Well, that is actually a part of the conversation, though, because there is a you can never go home again aspect to Mighty No. 9 in particular, and also, like, to an extent, Bloodstained Ritual of the Night, and, like, some of these other ones where it's like, well, you're recapturing something here, but it's not quite how I remember feeling in 1987 when I played it, or who I'm imagining a hypothetical person because I was 1 year old at that time. I wasn't doing that. I do think that some of the categories of, like, the solo comeback tour, as I called it, always felt a little bittersweet to me. And when I see those big splashy crowd funds, I tend to be skeptical. It's pretty rare to have an example of one of these where it really does scratch
the itch. There are a few that worked out. Pillars of Eternity was a really good game, and that was a good example of that. Ukulele was really well reviewed, and that was Banjo-Kazooie Spiritual Set. There are some examples, but yes, you're right. Sometimes you can't recreate that magic, and sometimes I think it's just the wrong people being involved. Like in the case of Mega Man, like it wasn't necessarily that they got some of the really talented, like, designers and artists who worked on the original franchise, as opposed to someone who's really, like, the key director who's bringing with him, like with Suikoden, for example. I could talk about that forever, but that, for people who aren't familiar, is an old Konami RPG series, and the director took along a bunch of, he had left Konami ages ago and the series was abandoned, but he took along a couple of key people from the old series to work on the spiritual successor that went big on Kickstarter, Ayuden Chronicles, last year when it was announced. He took along, like, the art director and a writer and some of the other key figures who were involved, and I think that is really the thing to look out for. And, like, as more and more of these Kickstarters happen, I think the thing to look out for was always, like, who is involved here? Because that's the most important part.
Yeah, the defining games of that Kickstarter era, or the defining game was Double Fine Adventure, was Broken Age, which is, I think, a really interesting one in the context of this conversation. Partly as a contrast to Thimbleweed Park, which I also think is a sort of interesting thing to think about. So let me see if I can explain what they were. Everybody probably knows what Broken Age was, but Double Fine Adventure was the sort of Tim Schafer and Ron Gilbert are going to come back and make the types of adventure games like Monkey Island that they made. This was the thing that sort of caused video game Kickstarters to blow up, and it was totally this. Mm-hmm. It was, we're going to make a spiritual successor to Maniac Mansion and Monkey Island. They started making the game together at some point. Gilbert actually left. He was going to go do something else. You can watch a whole documentary about this whole process. It's really fantastic. We've talked about it a bunch of times on the show, called Double Fine Adventure. It's on YouTube, and it's great. What's interesting about that is that they were going to make a point-and-click adventure game to, like, make all the people happy who hadn't had a point-and-click adventure game in 10 years or whatever. But then they wound up not being able to resist making something different, which is very Double Fine. It's very true, I think, to Tim Schafer, the game's writer's sort of his impulses as a creator. Is he's always like, well, I want to try something new. Let's do something new. Mm-hmm. And so the game is just, it's a kind of an odd game. Like, it's not my favorite, and it's not really, it doesn't scratch the itch for me of, like, playing a point and click adventure game, even though it is one, but it's sort of simplified in some ways. The way the storytelling and the art style work, it just is kind of its own thing.
Well, the first act is simplified, and then they reacted to the criticism by making the second act way too tough.
Right. There's also the difficulty. There's a lot about that game, but it's just sort of interesting issues, that they couldn't resist going and making something different. So then Ron Gilbert teams up with Gary Winnick, and they make Thimbleweed Park. And that game is, like, extremely true to Maniac Mansion and all that. Though I didn't finish it. Jason, I know you have, so maybe you can speak to that better. But I played a fair chunk of it, and that really gave me the nostalgia vibes. But also playing that, I was kind of like, okay, like, I don't really want to play a point-and-click adventure game anymore. So, like, it was kind of a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation, at least with those two games.
That's funny. I actually love that game until the ending, which
That's what I'm remembering.
The ending was very disappointing. But not the first Ron Gilbert game to have an ending that, that I thought
I did
was,
really like what I played. It was out. More, it was a kind of, you can't go home again. I was just kind of like, okay, I'm a little bored.
Like, that's funny. Yeah, well, that's the thing about recreating these childhood memories. I mean, yeah, you guys are right. You can't go home again, because some of it is, like, mechanics that just had to be in place at the time because they were the only... I mean, we talked about, like, how gameplay is just constantly building on itself. Back then, in the 80s, they didn't have anything to build on, right? They were pioneering this art form from the very beginning. So this concept of, like, an adventure game, and the reason those came about is is to tell stories, because other games were not telling stories at the time for the most part. And the kind of the verb system was this kind of messy, like kind of simple, like easy way to do things without necessarily having to like
can I
give
can
the
I
player.
Interject just that I know that we have like young listeners and also people who maybe don't know what you mean. Can
yeah,
you explain
yeah,
what
yeah.
the verb system
okay, so,
is?
Yeah, what's the verb
so,
system?
A point and click adventure game. So yeah, so back in the day, instead of doing actions in the game, you would kind of select them from this giant like table that would be on the bottom of your screen.
Like
so
take up
be,
a
like,
quarter of
look
the screen.
At, like walk to, yeah, yeah like push,
full of
pull.
Verbs.
And so you would see something on screen and then you would have to click one of the verbs right. and then click on the thing to do something with it. And that was kind of refined over time, and like Day of yeah. the Tentacle wound up taking that to a better direction
and full
then,
throttle,
like, making it simpler,
I feel
like, yeah. like the verbs got simpler over time, and then eventually they turned into like coin wheels and like other better ways of doing it. But now going back to the verbs, it just kind of feels like, oh man, like this is not aged well. So I actually think part of the spiritual successor and the challenges with that is finding that balance between like recreating what fans want to see and also making a game feel like it plays well in the modern era. I actually think Thimbleweed Park did do a good job of that. But yeah, I mean, if you're not used to like certain things, you're kind of like, man, this is boring. Same with playing like an old school JRPG in 2021. It's kind of like turn-based combat. Just it might have its moments at times, I guess, but sometimes it can be really boring. As you guys noted.
Mm-hmm. I was curious, Jason, while you're on that topic, I found these two examples on the internet. I can't confirm or deny if these are accurate, but supposedly people see Bravely Default as a spiritual successor to Final Fantasy mm-hmm. V, and they see Octopath Traveler as a spiritual successor to all of our favorite Final Fantasy VI. And there's already some speculation that the game Triangle Strategy, which we've talked about a couple times on this show, it's not going to be out until next year, but it looks kind of cool.
So yeah, Triangle Strategy looks like Octopath Traveler because it's the same people, but that's like a Final Fantasy Tactics.
Yeah,
successor.
That was my understanding.
Triangle Strategy.
Right. That's FF Tactics.
So that game, I can't wait for that game. That I'm so excited for that game. But yes, that's a Final Fantasy
Tactics.
I mean,
because Final Fantasy Tactics is the best Final Fantasy game, maybe?
Yeah. Also on my list, having been preceded by Tactics Ogre. Yeah. It's a couple
that's right.
Down.
Tactics Ogre.
They're all here, folks. Yeah. They're all
I think
here.
Octopath Traveler tried aesthetically to be like Final Fantasy VI, but it's really more like it's really more like Saga Frontier or like Live-A-Live or some other old school JRPGs. The Bravely Default chain is really interesting because that actually came from a game called Final Fantasy IV Heroes of Light that was on the DS.
Right.
And that was really the Final Fantasy, that was kind of the beginning of the Bravely Default like chain. And it was all the same developers. And that was very much like, we are recreating Final Fantasy, like old school Final Fantasy, not just five, but also like three. It has a lot from three, really closest to three, and a little bit of one as well. And so that kind of set the path of Bravely Default. But I wouldn't even say like maybe it's spiritual successors, but when it's the same company and a lot of the same people, I wonder if it's almost like just an evolution of the series that just has a different name, which I guess it could be a spiritual successor. Like I guess what would that be?
I have a whole category here for this thing.
But it's not the legally distinct.
Which I guess I should have put these JRPGs underneath this. Because
no, but
some
it's
of them-
not. But it's not the legally distinct sequel because they still had Final Fantasy. They still own Final Fantasy.
Right.
So it's more like
right.
the sequel with another name. Like that
well,
might be the best
that's
way to
a
call
legal
it,
distinction,
like
though,
that.
Right? Isn't that kind of, I mean, that is legally distinct.
No, but it's not for legal reasons, is the point. Oh, like,
right.
It's not like
right.
they lost
I see.
Access
sure,
to
sure.
the franchise.
Yeah. Like there are some other examples that I have here that are in that category. Like, for example, Perfect Dark was built on top of GoldenEye 007. Mm-hmm. Wonderful games, both. But Perfect Dark is much more pleasurable to play because they just fixed a lot of the things that felt finicky in GoldenEye. Mm-hmm. And also they introduced this whole story of Joanna Dark. She's a badass. Can't wait for the reboot.
Well, I assume they lost the James Bond license and that's why they did. Or they didn't want to deal with it. Sometimes it's like they might not want to deal with
that
license.
I don't know. I didn't look up that story, although I looked up most of the other ones. Like I mentioned Dragon Age Origins, and
that's
apparently the reason why this happened is because supposedly BioWare made an accounting error and lost the Baldur's Gate rights because of that, which seems incredibly absurd if it's true. I couldn't find a great source on that, but we can leave a link in the show notes to where one of the developers was quoted on that.
I 100% believe that. There's a story in sports about a guy who whose agent missed the deadline for faxing in his contract, and it cost him millions of dollars, and wasn't signed on the team because the contract came in at 12:02 instead of midnight or something like that.
It's tragic. I mean, now when you Google it, you find all the BioWare devs being like, we have no regrets about it. We're so proud of Dragon Age and what we've built, and building our own fantasy world was great. And it's like, yeah, you kind of have to say that though, because you got to be kicking yourselves. Like, what the heck happened?
Well, I wonder. Dragon Age is a pretty valuable franchise now. So it's nice.
Maybe not right now.
Well, sure. But I think that there's some value to saying, hey, if we're working with someone else's IP, we want to do our own spiritual successor and make our own thing, create our own IP.
Mm-hmm. Which is absolutely what they did. They were okay, we're going to make lemons out of lemonade. We're going to make something that is clearly inspired by and is considered by them and by fans to be a spiritual successor to Baldur's Gate, but it's completely their own, and they get to make up their own version.
Maddie, you just said make lemons out of lemonade, which
I was actually wondering if you were being clever and reversing it on purpose.
I wasn't, but let's say I was.
That should be a saying, though, right? Man, you really made lemons out of lemonade on that one. You had a great situation. That's a good one. It's like a snatching defeat from the jaws of victory.
Oh my God.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to think about what it would have been like if Dragon Age Origins had instead been Baldur's Gate 3, only because, I didn't really play Baldur's Gate, and I really like Dragon Age Origins, and I liked being able to get into a new world and learn the lore and learn the system and then be into this thing, which has actually been true for me a lot of times. There have been spiritual successors that have been the game that I got into this type of game with. Stardew Valley is a great example. I never played Harvest Moon, and I played 1,000 hours of Stardew Valley, and I don't know why exactly. I don't know if it was actually the changes or the improvements that Eric Barone made or what, but I love that game. And actually, I've never really played Earthbound. I keep buying it on different Nintendo systems. I own it on so many different platforms, but I've never really gotten that far, and I've played a little bit.
I mean, that game hasn't aged incredibly well.
Yeah, well, that's why. I play a little, and I'm whatever, but I love Undertale and played a ton of it and kind of have a similar experience with that, where that game, I guess it's that if Earthbound was
very
really
different.
Undertale,
I almost hesitated to include Undertale on this list.
Right.
I put it in its own category for a second, and then I moved it back. I was I don't know how to describe this, because that's more a meta commentary on games themselves, and also
I think
Earthbound.
It's a super spiritual successor, Turbo Plus.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, it started,
exactly.
If I remember correctly, it started as a fan game, an Earthbound fan game. So it is fair to call it some sort of, it has the lineage, but I wouldn't call it a spiritual successor necessarily. Stardew Valley is
straight
have mentioned up Harvest Moon.
But yeah, Stardew Valley is a good example.
This is a better version of Harvest Moon, which I think is kind of the or example of this whole spiritual successor thing, right? Your goal making a spiritual successor is to make the definitive a better version of what you made before or what someone else made
before.
Sometimes
it's to pick up loose ends or explore something that you didn't have a chance to explore in the original if you worked on the original.
Sure, but either way, you're always trying to make a game that's better than anytime you do anything, you're trying to do better than what you did before. So it's not
I think people Undertale aren't trying to make a bad game. That's
yeah, exactly. I don't know, maybe for the producers, people are just intentionally sabotaging themselves to for tax reasons.
Yeah. I think that's less likely. I'm still thinking about this, the idea of getting into a series or a type of game because of the successor, because there are some other examples that come to mind. I don't know if either of you have tried to play System Shock 2, but that game is very
not
user friendly.
Nope.
But I think that a whole lot of people played BioShock, and that was their first immersive sim, and it was their first game like that. And it's funny that it even has shock in the title, because now people would be like, oh, this is a BioShock style game. BioShock has kind of supplanted System Shock. And I think the same thing you could say is true of Dark Souls and Demon's Souls, which that was another kind of legally related thing. From Software just wanted to make another one of those. And now that the Demon's Souls remake is out and it's full fidelity, I mean, it looks better than any other FromSoft game, because the remake is
so
beautiful.
Out of lemonade situation, you might say.
Yes. The it's funny that like soul, when people talk about a Souls game, I mean, I guess it's nice that you can just use that shorthand that could mean either one. But for a long time, people would talk about a game that's like Dark Souls, and then there'd inevitably be the people who are like, actually, Demon's Souls was the first.
Actually, Demon's Souls was first.
Actually,
and then I'm sure
Kingsfield.
Someone's gonna write in and be like, Kingsfield, yeah, oh my god, you beat me to it. I almost put that in this extremely complex set of notes we have here, but I was like, you know what? Even I don't care about Kingsfield. But then we brought it up on the podcast anyway. This is important. It's important to get to that.
We got
to
get all the way back.
I feel like an interesting counterpoint as like an example of something where it is a spiritual successor, but it's more just like something the developer thought was personally interesting is the Assassin's Creed story. Where
I
like
didn't know this
apparently,
story.
Yeah, this is on Wikipedia. Okay. I didn't dive super deep into this, but the Wikipedia
comment.
Entry about it is very funny. So apparently Patrice Deulise was like assigned to make a Prince of Persia spinoff, and he was like working on it for a bit, but then he went to the library to read a bunch of stuff about like, you know, Persian assassins
princes
and like
Persia,
history
sure.
And then yeah, and like as he was reading them he found some books about assassins that he just thought were really cool, and he was like, what if the Prince of Persia is an assassin? And then like he went a step further, he was like, what if there's a league of assassins and also they're like all really cool and they're in history? And then after that he was like, I guess I'm not making a Prince of Persia game anymore, I guess I'm making some sort of Assassin's Creed game. And the rest, as they say, is history, literally, in those games. I just found it endearing.
I love this story because it's so relatable. Just because who hasn't had that experience of setting out to do one thing and then you start researching it and you're like, actually, damn, like the way more interesting story is this, yeah, this weird thing about like assassins. And did you know that the word assassin actually didn't always mean what we think it means? And like
senior at work
meetings and you're just like monologuing at everyone and they're like, I mean, you could make a game about this, I guess, if you wanted to.
I feel like more than one
Ubisoft new IP has come out of that, because Watch Dogs used to be a driver game and then they were all like, what if we wore hoods and
hacked? What if we hacked stuff?
What if it was set in Chicago?
Whoa. What if there was a cap that you wore and it was iconic?
What if you had an iconic cap?
An iconic cap.
That's really the question underlying Watch Dogs, is what if there was an iconic cap?
Yeah, I ask myself that every day. Yeah, I do feel like that's a really fun story. It's a lot more fun than BioWare's accounting error story. And all the IP issue stories that I have noted here, like Harmonix working on Guitar Hero and then making Rock Band later. Although that one's kind of funny to me because I remember getting a version of Guitar Hero World Tour, which was like the spinoff of Rock
Band,
that.
Like it
the
was
competitor
there.
To yes. it at the time. And they mailed it to the Phoenix. And so I had like all these instruments that I like took home with me. And I was always trying to convince my friends that they wanted to play Guitar Hero World Tour. And they were like, we would like to play Rock Band.
This, oh my God.
Don't.
This
wanna
is.
Play that.
I'm so with you. I had the same experience. So what was funny about this, and I had totally not thought about Guitar Hero and Rock Band. So the narrative here, right, is that like the people at Harmonix had been making Guitar Hero, and that game was really catching on. Guitar Hero 2 was like the best one, and then Activision, whenever like people left, there was this schism, and they go and a bunch of the people who were like apparently the main talent behind Guitar Hero. Left, started Harmonix, they made Rock Band, and Rock Band was like, what if there was drums? Like, what if it was the whole band and there was a singer, and it blew the whole thing up and that game was a huge hit. And then suddenly, Guitar Hero, which had been the sort of Vanguard series, was playing catch up. And I remember there was a whole narrative, for starters, which this was before I was really in games media, but I was aware of the fact that it was very much like, oh, like, these guys left to go indie and they're the cool ones and they made a good game and then, you know, the other guys are like trying to copy
and now
them.
They had to make their own version of it that was its spiritual successor that it was always meant to be.
Right,
and like Guitar Hero World Tour, who cares? Who wants it?
They literally left to start a Rock Band.
Right. No, and it has that total Rock Band narrative that also I think practically maybe even exists in one of the later Rock Band games where they started adding a story. And also, Maddie, I can just really relate to, there was a period where I had like, I had more plastic instruments than real instruments in my house, and everyone wanted to play
control.
Rock Band. Only Rock Band.
2008
was
a time like every party was Rock Band. There was like every kind of plastic instrument at every party.
You know,
it was great.
Speaking of nostalgia, do you think they're going to do like a spiritual successor to Rock Band? I mean, are they still making those? I guess there's like...
They kind of are, I guess.
The plastic instrument is such a... in our digital world, who's going to go to the store to buy plastic instruments?
But everyone misses that.
Yeah, you would just...
Well, there is
Fortnite or something.
Ubisoft has the Rocksmith. That's right. That's like the new version.
I've said this before, but like I gave Rocksmith a negative review at Kotaku, and that's the review of mine that I think is the wrongest over time that I've come to disagree with the most.
Wow, Pitchfork changing their scores. Kirk Hamilton coming
it's
forward.
It's really nice that I didn't give it a score, but I did give it a negative review because I was just like not into the idea of learning music that way. I've really come around on it, and I've even actually installed it on my PC and have played around with it some, and it's pretty cool, and it would be a pretty cool way to learn guitar. So I said that, but that's not the same as Rock Band. That's like a guitar teaching tool. It like makes a video game out of it, but it's designed to teach you guitar. You plug a guitar into it. But Rock Band, I think that we could see a spiritual successor for that at some point. Like people might get nostalgic for getting together in the living room and like playing together as post-pandemic. I don't know. Maybe this is going to be a prediction.
I mean, the problem with that, it's interesting.
There are a lot of problems with it, Jason. I'm aware of the problem.
Video
huge startup costs. Wildly impractical.
It's funny. I think of when all this metaverse stuff has been coming out, I've been thinking about stuff like that where it's like suddenly everybody's chasing this trend. It happened with Rock Band and Guitar Hero. Then THQ did those UDRAW tablets that like helped sync it. More recently, like 5-6 years ago, was the whole trend of Toys to Life, which was a humongous thing for like three years, and then it just suddenly ended. All of these things just move in these cycles, and every time I see people talking about the metaverse, I just keep thinking about that and how silly it all is and how it's just going to disappear.
Well, but the metaverse isn't plastic junk. I mean, I know you need a VR headset, but you don't even necessarily. But it's not quite. It's not toys and
it's
stuff.
It's not. Yes, right. but it's just fads. It's like how the industry just follows these fads, and then everybody moves on to the next thing. That's just what I'm talking about.
It's pods. I mean, it really all comes back to pods. I'm really glad to have the opportunity to bring up Pogs on the show. I don't know how we got here, but I'm just really glad that we are here.
Here's a thing. So this is kind of related to this in like wanting to have a multiplayer feeling that you had, which I do think there's probably some hunger for the Rock Band thing.
Are you going to talk about Back for Blood?
Yeah.
The game that inspired this topic in the first place,
yes.
And we haven't talked about it yet?
So I'm going to, that's what I'm doing. I'm steering us onto Back for Blood Boulevard.
Here we go.
So I've played a lot more of this game since I talked about it on the show. This game rocks, and it's such an interesting game because in a lot of ways, it's like a dressed up Xbox 360 game. Like it kind of is old fashioned when you're playing it. It's like, okay, this is a little just like there's nothing going on here. Really, that feels super current gen. It, like, given that Left 4 Dead was more than 10 years ago, like, it's kind of the same thing. And it actually has less features. Like, it has, you know, fewer multiplayer features. So it's kind of, it doesn't feel like super current, but it doesn't feel like any other multiplayer game that I can play. And I think that is, like, the real appeal of it. And that's sort of, when I think about a spiritual successor, it's this question of, like, what is the spirit of a game, right? Like, what does it mean, actually?
Is the spirit being succeeded or not?
Right. Yeah. Like, it's a really profound and almost like ethereal, beautiful idea, right? A spiritual successor. We're taking the spirit of this game and recreating it. So what does that mean? And in this case, it really is just this specific kind of vibe, like getting with three people and then just hopping in and like immediately playing and just playing for like an hour. And it's just sort of a thing you can kind of repeat. And it's not weighted down with all the like games as a service loot shit of like Destiny or Warframe or something. It's just way lower impact because it's from an earlier era where multiplayer gaming was just way lower impact. And I am at least much more nostalgic for that than I realized. And playing this game really drives that home.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting to play a game where you're collecting a bunch of doohickeys to level up your character, but you don't have to pay for any of them.
Right.
And like you're just collecting little doohickeys. Mm-hmm. And it does feel like it's from another time. And like the idea that you just keep playing the game and that's how you get better at the game and your character gets stronger is you just keep playing the game over and over, and your friends are ideally also continuing to play the game over and over at roughly the same rate as you. And you're all just hanging out together and playing the same game for a few weeks, and then maybe you move on to some other game. It's peak 2007.
It's nice,
it's peak Rock
right?
Band. Yes. It's really tapping in to that same four-player
good
vibe.
Example of a legally distinct sequel.
Right.
Well, I mean, it is by the same studio in this case. It is a legally distinct sequel.
I would
sequel,
say yes,
but
very much so.
It is also technically the same exact people making it again. And
I'm
it
sure
has
there's
the
some new
in
people,
it.
Right, too. Like, there's probably...
Yeah, no, I'm sure. Of course. But it's still Turtle Rock Studios. But yeah, Back 4 Blood, it's a pretty fun game, but I don't know if I'm going to keep playing it forever. I like enjoyed it for a few weeks, but it doesn't have the metaverse quality that Mark Zuckerberg wants to monetize. It's just, I don't want to live in there. I just want to hang out.
But I think that's a strength of the game, or at least that's like part of the nostalgia is playing this. And I haven't finished. I've gotten partway into Act Two, and knowing that the same group of people that I played with, we could just come back and play it again in a couple months if we're all bored. And it doesn't have, it's just, there isn't that Destiny thing where you come back and you're like, oh God, there's like four seasons have gone by since I last played and there's all this new stuff and I have to like totally reconceptualize my power level and I don't even know. And like one guy in our group was playing this whole time, so he's like the wrong level and he knows what to do, but we need him in our party. Like none of that. You can just go back to Back for Blood anytime in the next however long as the servers are running, and just play it a little bit more. And it's like so low impact in that way that too feels like a sort of capturing of the spirit of Left 4 Dead, which I should say is a game that like people still play as well and is still really fun because you can just still play it because it's the same game that it was, you know, 11 years ago when it came out.
I think part of why Back 4 Blood both does and doesn't feel nostalgic for me is because it feels like it is both recapturing what made Left 4 Dead great and yet also catering to the people who've been playing Left 4 Dead this entire time. So it's like for me, in theory, like the person who stopped playing Left 4 Dead in 2010 or so, but it's also kind of for the people who've just been playing Left 4 Dead since
I think they call themselves debtors. They're a hardcore debtors.
Yeah. debtors, yeah. Never left fours, they call themselves. Sure. Yeah, not left four behinds.
Before we go, I feel like I want to propose a fifth rubric here.
Okay, here we go.
This kind of fits into the fan letter, but it's different because I think that there should be a category for a game like The Rival where The Rival would be the name of the category. Ooh. Where a game comes out,
the Guitar Hero World Tour, if you will.
No, a game comes out and it's really bad or broken or busted, and then something else comes and everyone was like, this is the game it should have been. So like Torchlight to Diablo 3 is like everyone flocked to Torchlight 2 because it felt like what Diablo 3 should have been. Or like City Skylines when that terrible SimCity
that's a great one, let's go play
City Skylines. And I think there's a space
where it's like almost an accident that they come out at the same
sometimes. it's like serendipitous. Yeah, sometimes it's that, but oftentimes it's just like the narrative becomes like, oh, you don't like this, well come play this game that is a lot like it but way better.
Kind of like how the Final Fantasy MMO is for World of Warcraft players who are leaving, where it's like it's not a spiritual sequel but it's an emotional sequel for the person who's looking for a replacement.
that might be a different category. Not quite spiritual successor.
And people kind of seek this out. I like this category because people sought this kind of thing out when Cyberpunk was happening, like when that game came out. There was a lot of
a lot of articles were like, this is the Cyberpunk game you wish had been exactly. The other one.
It's like people look for that narrative.
I understand it. But yeah, I feel like my rubric is perfect, but I will accept this fifth entry.
I'm putting it in italics. Because it's
it's
like needs citation.
Sure.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Well, this was fun. This was fun to talk about. Wait,
you guys. Triple Click is a spiritual successor to Kotaku's Footscreen.
No, Triple Click is totally its own thing. I don't even know what you're talking about.
It might be a legally distinct sequel because we lost the IP, but we don't.
No, it's the stapler. Developers quit and then form a new studio that makes a game very similar to the one that made their prior studio.
Okay. This is a stapler.
This is a stapler.
I think the important thing is that Triple Click is an Office Space reference.
Exactly.
And we'll be back in just a second with one more thing.
Hey, kid. Your dad tell you about the time he broke Steven Dorff's nose at the Kids' Choice Awards?
In Dead Pilot Society, scripts that were developed by studios and networks but were never produced are given the table reads they deserve.
When I was a kid, I had to spend my Christmas break filming a PSA about angel dust. So yeah, being a kid sucks sometimes.
Presented by Andrew Reich and Ben Blacker. Dead Pilot Society, twice a month on MaximumFun.org.
You know, the show you like, that hobo with the scarf who lives in a magic dumpster.
Doctor Who?
Yeah! Hello, I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And we host Still Buffering, a cross-generational guide to the culture that made us.
Every week, we share media that made us who we are. Things like Archie Comics,
Sailor Moon,
and lots of Taylor Swift.
And now that Riley's an adult, it comes with 100% more butts.
And now I am totally comfortable with it.
So check out new episodes of Still Buffering every Thursday on MaximumFun.org.
Butts, butts, butts. Join in, Riley. Butts, butts, butts.
Butts, 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 butts.
And we are back with one more thing. Jason, why don't you go first? Because your one more thing is what my one more thing was last week.
It's like the relay one more thing.
Yes, I have begun jumping into Guardians of the Galaxy. And unlike you, Maddie, I am actually quite delighted by this game. I'm surprised at how much I'm enjoying it and how much it feels like better than the MCU movies. I really just enjoy the writing. The writing just really pops for me. I'm up to like chapter 5 of this game. For people who aren't familiar, it's a totally new Guardians of the Galaxy take that really feels like it's trying to, the characters definitely feel like they're trying to be their MCU equivalents. I say this as someone who hasn't read the comics, so it might just be everyone's trying to be the comics, but to me it feels very much like Drax is talking exactly like Drax.
Yeah, Rocket
in the film
is extremely
like
Bradley Rocket. Cooper.
They're right all now. Exactly much like facsimiles of their MCU versions. But for me, it really works in a way that the Avengers characters didn't. I think the performances are just way better than like the Avengers. It really is a good contrast to the Avengers game that came out last year, because this feels like what I want from a new Marvel game in 2021. I really am enjoying it, and like to me, it's so snappy and fun. And like the performances are just really good. The writing is just like the gameplay is whatever, just shooting things. And it's cool,
yeah,
whatever,
to
use the abilities.
A lot of spheres.
Like, mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of QTEs, a lot of just using abilities, spamming abilities, and that's whatever. But like to me, the writing has been just really good. And I really want to see what's going to happen next in the story. I'm just really enjoying the banter and like making decisions. What I really like is just how much of it is there is. Like in every mission, you're constantly being asked to make these decisions and like choose one line of dialogue or another.
Yeah, I mean, it is true. They are constantly talking. Like, it's like either
Which
this
I
is
am
the
really
thing
enjoying.
You love.
Right, it's just, it's very funny that this was the thing that Maddie was not
yes.
so hot on last
yeah,
week.
The thing,
we are
the
describing
thing
the
are,
identical
right.
qualities.
Yes,
yeah.
yes, the thing that yeah. you were down on, I'm very high on. I'm up to like chapter 5, just really enjoying it. We'll do a triple play on this in a few weeks, so we'll get more in depth on this game. But for now, I just want to mm-hmm. say I played a bunch and I really like it. So if people are on the fence and they think they might be interested, I mean, I'm super enjoying it so far.
Yeah, it'll be fun to talk about.
Yeah, I have some more thoughts about all the talking, but I'll save it for the triple play.
Yeah,
there's
save it.
Yeah, I've played as much as you, Jason, and I'm generally enjoying it too, I'll just say. But yeah, we'll talk about it when we do a whole episode about it.
Mm-hmm. Kirk, what else are you playing?
Oh man, so I want to tell everyone about a game that I'm not going to tell them too much about, because it's one of those games that's better if you don't know a lot about it. It is a game called Inscription that's out on PC and is a super, super cool game. Okay, so this game is made by Daniel Mullins, who made a game called Pony Island. I know that's really well known. Like, he's kind of known for making games like this, though I haven't played one of his games before. And it's a card, it's like a deck building roguelite, sort of, but it's also a mystery, and it's also an escape room, and it's also this like meta layer mind fuck kind of a thing that is the reason that I don't want to say too much about it, because the delight of this game, and I am really into this game. I've played like 7 or 8 hours of it. I'm pretty far. It's just in the discovery and the like finding these weird secrets and these layers to the game as it kind of peels back for you and you realize like what is going on. Like this just happens constantly. You'll be playing and it'll challenge you or surprise you in some delightful, weird way, and you'll realize that there's this new layer to it that you didn't understand. So it's one of those. I'll say that this isn't a huge spoiler because the game begins this way, but this game starts, you load it up, it's very old school looking. It actually looks a little like Return of the Obra Dinn, the visual style. It has that kind of degraded old like Macintosh graphics look. And it loads up with this screen where you have to click the mouse, click to start, and you can't start a new game. You can only continue. And also, you're clearly within, like in a game within a game, like you're on someone else's computer at the very beginning. And it's like, okay, we're starting the game now, and then you start the game, and then you're in the game. And then it's like, so there's layers deep from the very start, and that just continues throughout. So you're already a little off balance at the very beginning of it. You're like, okay, what? And then the experience, the early hours of this game are also very confusing. And there's a lot of sort of unfair game mechanics. There are things that are thrown at you that you just don't understand. And actually, the card game at the heart of it, I think, is really good and really fun as I've learned how it works. But also, because the game is working in all these other weird layers, there are just times where it like messes with you or where you have to think outside of the game to kind of get to make progress. I've found it to just be so, so cool. I gather that the two of you aren't playing it, so I don't know if we're going to talk about it more on the show. I really want someone to talk to about this game.
I played a bunch of it. I mean, I got to the second boss and was kind of like, all right, I don't know if this is for me, but it sounds like I need to play more.
There's a lot more than that. Yeah, like, so that's not, I mean, but I don't want to say anymore.
Maybe I'll give it a shot. I don't really like card games generally, but yeah. I do like mysteries and all the other stuff you mentioned, so maybe I could convince myself.
There's a lot of card game in it.
There's a lot of mysteries as well, and I've kind of gotten into the card game too. Like, I don't love card games either. I guess I got really into Gwent, but like, you know, it's a fun game with cool rules, but that's not really my kind of game. But I'm so much more into the adventure of it. And at this point, I mean, I'm far enough into it that like, it's just gotten really wild and I need to know what happens next. I keep finding myself playing this game until like midnight when I meant to go to bed an hour earlier, which is kind of
always a good sign.
Yeah, the best endorsement I can give of it. So it's a really, really cool game. I just wanted to get it on anyone's radar who hasn't heard of it. And I won't say any more, but yeah, it's called Inscryption, and it's Inscryption, CRYPT. So, yeah,
right.
Pretty easy to find.
It's a cool way of spelling Inscryption.
Yes, it
with
is.
A Y.
And sweet. It's a neat game.
All right. Well, I'm playing a game too. So I beat this little 4-hour indie game that is called Unpacking. I played it for PC, but it's also on Switch and Xbox. Not sure if it's on PlayStation. I don't think so.
Maddie, you have me at 4 hours.
I know, right? I don't know if this would be you two's vibe or not. Maybe it's just because I'm really tired of all the talking in Guardians of the Galaxy. No offense to that game. I just wanted something where that was not the vibe at all. And this game is the total opposite vibe. There's no text. There's no talking. There's no people in this game. It's like House Flipper in the sense that you're just walking around a house, clicking on stuff.
Are you like unpacking? Like,
you are unpacking. Oh, you are unpacking. However, and I started this game just thinking it was going to be like House Flipper. It was just unpacking. Mm-hmm. I saw the way I found unpacking was because Robert Zachney was playing it on a Waypoint stream, and it was like so relaxing to watch him clicking on like a little teddy bear to remove it from a box and then clicking on a pillow to like put the teddy bear on the pillow. And I was like, just doing that with like a billion things in a room. And then when you're done, it's like, look at this beautiful bedroom. I was like, this looks like the greatest game, like dopamine up the wazoo forever.
I can't believe you want to do this after moving this year.
I like unpacking in real life because I have problems. We like moved here and I unpacked instantly. And Dina was like, I'm learning so much about you, like that you're insane. I like immediately unpacked everything. And she was like, is it cool if I don't unpack right away? And I was like, yeah, no, that's fine. I just need to do this with my stuff. No, I need to know where it is.
I totally get it. There's something very calming about unpacking, and especially unpacking when you just have to click on things. It doesn't even require anything of you.
Way like, better. Very, very it's soothing. Like cleaning the windows in House Flipper is so soothing because you're just clicking on the dirt and it magically disappears.
And then it's clean.
This is like that, but unpacking, and everything's adorable. So I didn't expect there to be a story, but there actually is a story, and it's a purely environmental storytelling mode because there can be nothing else. And so you have the character move in with roommates, and like the tension is like she has to figure out where to put her stuff with like all this other shit around, and then like you can like see the stages of her life. I won't spoil it
spoiled,
but it's actually really rad and like heartwarming and poignant at various parts. And I was so into it, and it just put me in a really good brain zone for a few hours. So I really recommend it. It's called Unpacking.
Unpacking.
Yeah.
Unpacking. That's like, what's that style of game? Like House Flipper and Visceral Cleanup, like Soothcore or something. There's got to be a name for it, right? Where it's like just calming activities.
Soothcore.
Yeah, or like the Power Washer Simulator.
Yes, Power Washer Simulator is a great example.
Yeah.
Yes.
Kirk, that's a good, I feel like you just invented it on the fly. Soothcore. That's pretty
Soothcore.
Good.
I bet if you Googled it, it already exists. Nothing is
like,
new.
I mean, you couldn't call the genre this, but it very much is romanticizing chores. Like, it's not what it's like to do chores in real life. It's purely the nice thing about doing a chore where you're checking it off the list. It's only that and none of the actual work of doing the chore.
Well, Maddie, that's all video games.
Well, no.
I know.
Right. I mean,
that's why they're so good.
Yes, this has been said many times. The visceral cleanup detail is actually most games just in reverse, but it's the same thing.
Yeah.
You walk into a room full of monsters and you clean out all the monsters with your shotgun.
Yes, of course. Anyway, great stuff. So this has been another triple click.
It has been.
We did it again.
It
folks.
Has. Hey. It has been.
We
it
did
has
it.
Been
we
another made it. Triple click. Another right, spiritual well. Successor.
Mm-hmm. No, we're our own.
Look
thing.
Out next week for our next week will be our spiritual successor to this week's episode.
That is
okay.
True.
Yeah, I guess that is true. That is true. All right, we'll see you next week for that.
All right, see you next week.
Bye.
Triple Click is produced by Jason Schreier, Maddie Myers, and me, Kirk Hamilton. I edit and mix the show and also wrote our theme music. Our show art is by Tom DJ. Some of the games and products we talked about on this episode may have been sent to us for free for review consideration. You can find a link to our ethics policy in the show notes. Triple Click is a proud member of the Maximum Fun Podcast Network, and if you like our show, we hope you'll consider supporting us by becoming a member at MaximumFun.org/join. Find us on Twitter at TripleClickPod, send email to TripleClick@MaximumFun.org, and find a link to our Discord in the show notes. Thanks for listening. See you next time.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned. Audience supported.